somebody in front of that there, just moved a little bit, let me see. There we go, see, yeah, sunlight. Okay, so what I've noticed is that in the Thomas Marshall literature, which I occasionally dip into when I have a little bit of spare time, there's a lot of talk about the web and cognitive capitalism and how the internet's a great thing and how it's helping capitalism transform, or it's a bad thing and it's making work worse. But I've noticed there's been very little sort of inquiry into the actual creation, production, and maintenance of the internet and web itself. And these are very human products, of very human people with particular goals and ideological visions. So what I do is I'm basically giving a sort of introduction to the background of the internet and web from a sort of vaguely autonomous perspective. So the web is important because it's a bit different from TV, as was argued by Michelle. You know, it's perhaps the dominant mode of production now, that everyone's like, oh, it's symbolic, linguistic production. What they really mean is people sitting in front of keyboards, typing to each other, downloading files, that sort of stuff. You know, factories controlled via the internet, all sorts of measurements of the internet, obviously really important. So where did it come from? What we're going to do is we're going to expose the light of day, the sort of governing forces, bodies, and people behind a lot of the net and the web. And it's very interesting. This is Tim Berners-Lee, who we'll talk about quite a bit, the quote-unquote inventor of the web, although the web was, of course, a collective grassroots thing, which he freely admits, nonetheless, he's been credited. So why do we call these people aristocrats? What makes them different from anyone else? Well, you know, generally you have the material aristocracy, the people who are CEOs, stockbrokers, army generals, government officials, whatnot. People who are doing rather good off of capitalism, enjoying themselves. Their ability usually comes from their ability to command force, to move matters, bits of matter, across the ground. The immaterial aristocracy, on the other hand, don't actually command much force. They can't have you executed, they can't have you, you know, punished. They don't have, in general, that much money. What they have, though, is they have the innovative ideas which can change the world, and they're recognized for this by the material aristocracy. They're also, you know, they're sort of, well, a lot of people, the ancient idea of the aristocracy, most of them are quite humble about what they do. They're quite dedicated. They have sort of those sort of characteristics for the most part. So why digital? Why are they have some digital sovereignty? What does that mean? Well, it simply means this, you know. Their realm is digital production, digital creation, digital maintenance, computers. So we're just using digital as a shortcut for computers. Right? And most of their ideas which they put out there are ideas which are common. They're based on either open source software, free software, or for the most part on the web. There's not actually, the software doesn't really matter. What matters is the standard, the creation of the open standard, and the negotiation between the material aristocracy, the corporations, the desires of the multitude of the users, which are sort of driving this process forward as a motor, and the vision and the coding abilities of immaterial aristocrats to sort of help the users fulfill their desires, the capitalists make some money, and the immaterial aristocrats get some bizarre meritocracy, some position of power. So where does it all begin? Well, it begins with AI, artificial intelligence. The material, you know, the labor was can revolt. This is bad. Why don't we replace them with machines? Okay, so we have the height of the Platonic project. We will reduce human productive processes to pure rationality, embody this rationality into machines, and the machines will run the productive processes without the workers. So John McCarthy, the coiner of the term artificial intelligence, said, everyone will learn how to program. That's how we're going to speak to the servants. Okay, did it work? Human, you know, there was talk earlier about tacit, you know-how. And computers are very bad at know-how. They have no sense of embodiment. Right now, AI people have given up on rationalizing all human behavior in terms of, say, deductive logic. And they're now focused on, you know, building cute little robots and whatnot. But it's pretty pointless. However, one of the original critics of the AI sort of initiative said, let's forget intelligence completely. Let's take the project of one of constructing the world's largest hypertext system. Was Scythe, which was a sort of doomsday AI project, functioning as a radically improved counterpart to the Dewey Decimal System. Such a system might facilitate what numerous projects are struggling to implement: reliable, content-based searching and indexing schemes. Okay, so Brian Smith went off and started doing metaphysics, never got around to this. Luckily, other people were working on it and had it working out the whole time. So AI, you know, it was mostly professors, mostly heavily employed by DARPA, the military-industrial complex. And what they noticed is that their students didn't care about AI. Their students just liked programming. These were grad students, mostly. They started, you know, their rumpled clothes, their unwashed hair and unshaven faces, they exist only for the computers. So the poor professors were shocked at this uncouth behavior by their grad students. And the grad students said, you know, I enjoy this. This is a community of joy. It's not a rejection of my body. I just really enjoy programming. You know, you don't want to stop. We'll sleep at the lab. That's Richard Stallman, who invented this thing called Copyleft, which we all talk so much about. Okay, so while this whole AI project was busy collapsing and imploding upon itself, and a sort of precursor to the dot-com burst called the AI winter, the internet was being laid out. The original name of the internet was the Galactic Network, which is very sort of vaguely Zapatista-like. Or the Network of Networks, or something that also sounds sort of familiar there. It's from this guy called Linklater. And he was also an MIT guy, employed by government. But he said, we have to figure out new principles for networking. Previously, all networks could only talk to other nodes of the network. But we want communication on the best effort basis. And you can't guarantee it's going to get there, but we're going to try. We have no global control. And when the packets go from, when the information, the communication goes from one node to the other, we hopefully won't keep a record. Now, of course, nowadays things are changing. So that's how TCP/IP works. Since you have two bits, you have the transmission control protocol, the internet protocol. Internet protocol, basically the idea is let's give all the computers this, on the same number system. We'll call this their IP address. The TCP/IP will take any data you give it, break it into smaller bits, send it out over the net, and say, in the name of God, to the next computer, please take this little data to the end of whatever address I gave it, and then TCP/IP will sit on the other end and we'll get all the packets in, and when they all come in, we'll reassemble them. So it's sort of soft assembly as the basis of the internet. This is not, you know, it's sort of peer-to-peer. It's not a, this is the 70s here. It's not a new idea. Also, however, the question is, how do you govern this thing? Because it got out of control, right? You know, it started out as a military project. The military said, oh, well, you know, it sort of works, but we're not all interested in it. So they split MILNET from ARPANET in 84. And it needed some sort of governing body, especially if it started spreading outside of the USA. And there's all these hobbyists that call themselves the internauts, you know, whatnot. And after much struggle and things, they came up with this thing called the Internet Engineering Task Force. What they did is they had something called Internet Research Task Force. They threw all the scientists and military people in and let them do research, while the more practical day-to-day running of the internet was taken over by mostly the hacker class. Okay, it's called the Internet Engineering Task Force. Their credo, from David Falk from IT, who was speaking in Oxford yesterday, is we reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and voting, running code. So yes, the internet runs off consensus, disturbing as that is. Doesn't even really run off good consensus. They just say, yeah, close enough, let's see if it works. So you don't have voting. You don't even have majority voting. You prefer actual implementation of arguments, which are decided by the effectiveness of practice rather than any ideological debate. If you do too much ideological debate, you tend to lose respect. You get kicked out. They divide things into working groups. Their main production is called a request for comments, which after many years will eventually become an internet standard. There are no membership lists. You cannot participate as an organization. You can only participate as an individual, even if you are, let's say, even being paid to participate. Okay? There are no requirements. You only know as ITF member through your activity over the listserv, through your coding. Leadership is informal. The saying is, a weekend is when you get up, put on your comfortable clothes, and go do your steering group work. And yes, anarchists got involved. Why not? Particularly a famous, I'm from Edinburgh, there's this famous Edinburgh anarchist called Ian Heavens, organizer of the Scottish Anarchist Federation, samba enthusiast, that's him playing samba down there, and, you know, founded the first sort of anarchist internet archive called spunk.org, and he also, in his spare time, worked very extensively on debugging TCP/IP. He found quite a number of bugs in them, one of which was not corrected until February 2002, and this is incorporated in IETF RFC 2525. Unfortunately, Ian Hebbins also committed suicide shortly before the publication of the RFC because the media discovered him. They published a little article saying, "Anarchists use information highway for subversion." Blaring headline, mentioned him by name, got him fired, you know, sort of suspended from his job. He had to cut all connections to the IETF, cut all connections to the Scottish anarchist scene. Very bad. And they noticed back in the day that we've been amazed at the level of organization these extremist groups have appeared on the internet in such a short time. Well, geez, I wonder why. He was one of the people behind it, and he was propagating it through workshops, some of you may have been there, in Britain for years before it became relatively mainstream. Oh, wait a second. Let's skip this one. Okay, now, another IETF participant was called Tim Berners-Lee, and he was a software consultant with a nuclear lab in CERN. He said, you know, we have all these machines, and none of them talk to each other, and I just want to share my notebook and my phone book with your notebook and your phone book, and I can't do that. So he thought of this idea called a universal information space. He called it a universal information space in 1989 in his first proposal, which he told his boss, give me 1 year and 2 employees, and I'll implement this thing called the web. The boss wasn't too impressed, and it approved the proposal. Regardless, Tim Berners-Lee, in his sort of spare time, worked on this, got some stuff running, and said, basically, you know, I'm going to put the idea on the web, on the net, and see if people like it. And he's very into this idea of universality. He kept saying, for people to share knowledge, the web must be universal, a universal space. And I spend most of my life defending this core property. Because, why did he have to defend it? Because that's kind of arrogant of him, right? I'm going to say we're on a universal information space, the internet's based on a decentralized space. Why should one sort of protocol be universal and the rest not be? So the IETF abolished and the URI working group, where they're making the web basically, and said, it's too arrogant, you guys keep arguing about philosophy, forget it. It was luckily managed to be resurrected, and the compromise was struck where Tim Berners-Lee says, okay, I'll call it uniform resource identifier, we'll keep the U, my head will still be universal, and we're going to get the web out there. His second main concept was the idea of a resource, which is a resource is anything. So, and a URI is an identifier for a resource. Originally, all these resources were web page. And, you know, people, the web was sort of academic, you know, it wasn't all that big. But then, sort of grad student Mark Anderson made this thing called the Mosaic browser, had graphics. All of a sudden, it took off. And there was this sort of crisis in the material aristocracy because the IETF, operating by rough consensus, moves very slowly. And all of a sudden, there was all these corporations involved in the web, putting up websites, trying to make money off browsers, and this led to what's called the browser wars. I'm sure you remember when you go on the internet and, oh, you can only view this with Netscape, or you can only view this with Internet Explorer. This was a big problem, right? Because all of a sudden the universal space became fractured by which browser you were using. So, you know, the hackers were just crying at this point because their concept had been destroyed. And what they decided is we need to sort of reconstitute our digital sovereignty. We've lost it to Microsoft and Netscape. Let's get it back. Berners-Lee, of course, being sort of central to the whole web initiative, was very upset at this. And he said, we're going to call something called the World Wide Web Consortium, which will be the body de facto by for web standards will be much faster than IETF. And the way we're going to be much faster is we're going to change. We are no longer going to be an absolute democracy, but we're going to be a representative democracy. And we will get all the corporations on board by telling them to join and then charging them a whole lot of money. And that's how we're going to fund ourselves. And then, you know, as Tim Berners-Lee said, the competitive nature of the group would drive developments and I would bring everyone to the table for the next issue. And yet, members also knew that collaboration was the most efficient way for everyone to grab a share of the rapidly growing pie. Okay, so this is return to universality. They were very happy at this. And they've got Netscape and Microsoft to jump on the same table. Now, this is a problem, though. So someone said, oh, well, maybe the open source movement is just a reconstituted state and all just trying to get jobs. That's not true. Okay, maybe on the statistical, you know, the number of people, maybe a lot of them are really bad coders trying to get jobs. Most of the people that do the actual coding are not terrifying interested in their job, or maybe in a small company at most. They're committed to their ideas. That's why the code is so good. That's why it works. This is the problem because if you're reconstituting the web on a representative democracy based on corporations You will have only stupid people. Okay? Almost guaranteed. This will be a problem. Okay? So we have to get the smart people back in. How are we going to do this? Well, we're going to sneak them in the back door. We're going to get a staff. So Tim Worsley says, I'm going to hire all the smart people I know to be on my staff, pay for them with Microsoft's money, and we're going to let them through the back doors, invite experts, and even though the process will be representative, we will open up everything on open listservs about anyone to comment, anyone to get involved, and if you get involved enough, maybe we'll hire you. So this initiative for hackers to join, basically. And this got the creativity going. So what does the standards body do? Well, it starts making standards. Particularly XML took off, and blogs, RSS, all this stuff more or less came out of W3C or descendants of the W3C process. All of the key ideas were almost entirely implemented and thought of by hackers, not corporate people. The only idea that is worth thought by corporate people, like XML schema and stuff, are generally considered really bad ideas. Web services, it's not working all that well right now. Okay, now there's another bizarre connection between communism and Google, of all things. The Project CyberSend in Chile was an interesting project. Sergio Allende came to government. There was a radical biologist called Maturana who worked under him, and they had this idea of, we need a network. If we can only control our socialist economy like a network, have real-time feedback, wouldn't this be great? Let's hire some crazy British guy called Stafford Beer to come over and help us create this project. We're called Project CyberSend. And this is Allende here saying, meanwhile, decentralizing worker-participative anti-bureaucratic network that will allow each worker to communicate to others in a manner ahead of its time and contribute both physically and mentally to the productive process. Okay, and they started, they got it sort of working. They managed to, you know, defuse a sort of strike with their CyberNet protocol. This is the command center, which is going to be in Allende's sort of near his office, so they could watch everything that was going on in real time. And, of course, a little bit, took a bit longer than they were hoping, and by the time they got it almost working, Pinochet, revolt, dead, didn't work out. The key maker of it, Fernando Flores, was put in jail, tortured for 3 years, thanks to Amnesty International. He got out. Where did he go? He fled to Berkeley to do a PhD. And that's where he met Terry Winograd, who's actually a very important, if not very well-known player. Terry Winograd was the wunderkind, the boy genius of AI, who got the rational product of AI, project of AI off the ground, working in some locations. But however, he eventually gave up, and he started reading Heidegger, and he went hard mad. He went mad for a good 20 years, and the process of AI failed. And then Winograd, he liked Heidegger, Flores liked Heidegger, they met up, they started talking. And Terry Winograd's like, yes, I see. What we need to end, the problem with AI is that we're trying to replace humans. We don't want to replace humans. We want humans to work together better with machines. We're going to start working on something called HCI, human-computer interactions, help found the discipline. Look at the design of computational processes, make them easy for humans to interface with. Okay, one of Terry Winograd's students was Larry Page. Larry Page co-founded Google. So, and he was forced to read a book by Fernando Flores and Winograd. And this is 5 minutes. Okay. So basically, Google developed page ranking, looking very cleverly. I'm sure you guys know about this. I'm not going to go into it too much. But they basically took technological advantage of the social process. Tim Berners-Lee, on the other hand, started saying, well, geez, I don't want people to share web pages. I want people to share data. I want people to share data about anything. We'll have this thing called the semantic web, which he stole from Foucault, actually, the order of knowledge. We'll have something called, rules and logic, and we'll all work over the web, and we'll have this giant decentralized artificial intelligence. Okay? And all the good AI people, particularly Pat Hayes, who've been hiding out since the destruction of AI in the 80s, came back and said, yes, we'll help. At the same point, Google is saying, oh dear, we're not going to do any evil, but to maintain, they're in a position where they might lose their hegemony, so they're... First thing Google did is Google closed down. They didn't let any information outside the company. They changed all their algorithms. They no longer use page ranking. They're buying up miles and miles of dark fiber. No one knows what Google's doing. Okay, unlike W3C, Google's not communicating, not involved in all the other. People know more about what Microsoft is doing than what Google's doing. Okay, very interesting. And also, Google's hiring all the old AI people. Mysterious. At the same point, digital sovereignty is going to come into full crisis. IP addresses used to be assigned by this guy called John Postel, an ITF volunteer, had a heart attack, died. They gave it to a corporation called ICANN, who in their last public meeting in Ghana decided to reduce public participation. And they proceeded to give the .com domains to a for-profit corporation called VeriSign, which then proceeded to redirect everyone's mistyped URIs to their webpage to get advertisements. This, I might add, broke the web and broke all sorts of software. Caused a major crisis. The United Nations got together and said, geez, we really, why don't we take control of how things are named on the web? This would be good. Tim Berners-Lee said, yeah, I support you. I'd much rather the UN do it than a for-profit corporation. And the UN started this process to figure out how we're going to take control of some of the upper-level internet architecture. This began the World Information Society movement. There was a, but you know, the UN's not all very friendly. Riot cops destroyed the sort of anti-globalization free media lab, and it's not looking pretty good. So what's the point? What is the point of all this technology? What's the point of the web and AI? Well, Lyotard said basically his crazy idea, in which he says, it isn't any human desire to know or transform reality that propels this techno-science, but cosmic circumstance. Basically, the sun's going to blow up. We're all going to die. So if that's what's going to happen, then it doesn't matter if we destroy the planet as long as we can create artificial intelligence which can survive in non-terrestrial conditions. Okay. Therefore, all capitalism, its goal is to produce AI to shoot off in outer space to escape the impending solar collapse. However, the capitalists, you know, it's pretty clear what they thought was a good idea. The AI thing didn't work. They withdrew their funding from it. But what did work was the internet and globalization, because fundamentally it's cheaper, especially with global communication infrastructure, to get just cheap humans and to build robots to replace them with. Pretty simple logic. So what does this mean? Well, first thing, these, you know, organizational miracles that people keep talking about, they're happening all the time. They're not even really often, they're usually not being spearheaded by Thomas Marxists. They're usually being spearheaded by just sort of random people. I think the IETF and Berners-Lee and W3C would be good examples of this. There's a very strong feedback cycle between technical infrastructure and class composition. So, to steal a line from Hart, if you know, if the old industrial era was electricity and the Soviets, right? The new era is like the web and the multitude, right? You have a technological process, you have a social process. They're very tightly coupled. Now, we're having a large crisis in digital sovereignty right now, with the ICANN crisis barely passing, the UN still making all sorts of bizarre noises about what they might do with the web. And I don't know if you know, but in the U.S. they passed this new bill which would fundamentally develop a multi-tiered internet. Therefore, if you wanted to go get data, it would come much faster from, say, Google's website than indie media. Okay, fundamentally destroying the fabric of the net. So this is very bad. W3C and IETF are back in a moment of crisis. And well, what should economists, Marxists, and other sort of revolutionaries do, militants? Well, geez, now would be a good time to get involved. because there's not that many people involved. They need help, and they're asking for help, and they're only experiencing, you know, the government more or less has left them alone for 30 years, and the corporations took over, they managed to re-seize on some level at least the conceptual ideas of the web and internet back to the corporations. Now it's under clear and ever-present assault right now. And this is very important, I think, globally, because, you know, regardless of the explosion of the sun, you know, climate change and whatnot, you have a global ecological crisis. You have a global, you know, you have global class antagonism. It would be very bad if the web went down or stopped working or was particularly tiered so that content from indie media or from peer-to-peer systems was given second class, third class, fourth class, destroyed status. So, If the web is one of the defining technological characteristics of the multitude, one of the characteristics of a crucial component, we really should understand it. We should understand the people and the organizations, which I've given you a very brief tour of, behind it, and we should think tactically how we could take the immaterial aristocracy, increase the antagonism between them and the material aristocracy, and develop some sort of way forward which preserves the web, preserves a sort of growth of universal antagonism. So that's it.
Excellent. Okay, we've got 5 minutes and a bit for some questions. If we have any questions or points arising?
Can I make one more quick point?
Loud, please.
One quick point. Actually, the connection between communism and then goes back further to the 1950s. Bank said that they wanted to create a computer to run the entire centrally planned economy in Eastern Europe. The CIA reported that they were going to build this thing called the Unified Information Network, and that's why ARPA poured all the money into building the net, because they want, they saw it as another potential school. So actually, it's fear of communism that built the net, and that is why the net is, why it's called, is communist, because it was based on the Russian model, and they were people who were trying to save the Soviet Union from Stalin.
Wow.
Reimagine the future is not there, coming out of it.
Well, it's fantastic. I love it. But I would love, if I understand you well, you're saying something interesting. That is, this aristocracy is more or less, it's split into
camps, yeah.
Camps, that is, corporation on one hand, multinational,
it's
transnational,
some is corporate,
and
some is
hackers, and so on. Okay. And this aristocracy, unwillingly opened the door for a universal democracy, democratic general system, isn't it?
Well, that you say? It depends who you talk to. So, for example, I think Vint Cerf, one of the head people behind the internet, who now works for Google, which is rather scary, and is the chairperson of ICANN, he's a horrible capitalist who just wants to make money. A lot of people like Berners-Lee are actually a more sort of, they're universalists, they're Quakers. They're sort of interested in this whole global democracy thing, but in a very vague way, they don't think about it too much. But I think there's some ideological division.
Right, but when you finish your paper saying that it would be interesting to foster some alliance and other, and don't you think the discussion between open source and free software was one of the key points? Because on the one hand, open source seems more general, more democratic, but in fact, it leads to enclosures and property enclosure. Whereas Free Software Foundation, with all its, because sometimes it's boring with the license and general public license, finally use the law and copyright law in order to preserve public system and not with an enclosure device, as an enclosure device. So don't you think that could be, but the problem is that is open source not a winning over free software?
Well, it is. And it was also primarily because people, particularly activists, don't understand the distinction between open source and free software. Free software is a much harder ideological distinction, a different set of licensing. And so basically free software you put out into the commons and it will stay in the commons forever. That's not necessarily the case with open source. Okay, there's been a lot of conflict within the hacker community over those two. Free software people are definitely losing. And it's even scarier right now with this thing called web services, which like Google Maps or Google Mail, which is that your application will run over the web, in which case the code is not released. The code is all behind company servers. What's even scarier is all of your mail, all of your photos, are on company servers. That's useful for data mining, can be given to government. This happened with the journalist from China recently being arrested because Yahoo gave all his email to China. This is very common. And that the latest version of the GPL being put forward by Stallman says, if you're going to produce a web service like Gmail, and if you want to use GPL code, you have to actually take the code out of Gmail, or whatever the web service is, and put that code up for public download, right? You can't, because what's happening, a lot of these web services are actually based on free software, just running behind company firewalls and can't actually access the source. And this has led to a large fight in between Linus of Linux fame and Richard Stallman, because Linus doesn't even want Linux to use GPL3. This is a big problem. Okay, so there's all this antagonism happening now on the ground.
I'm not sure if it's good thing to make a sharp distinction like that between free software and open source, because open source exists in many different formats. And some of them are very close to free software. Yeah. And what it has done is it actually, that's what created the explosion of it. Because if free software was much too ideological, and it just didn't make much headway actually before it became open source. So I'm not sure we have to.
Well, I think as militants, we should attempt to influence things towards free software and try to distinguish between the two if possible. But yes, it's very hard to run your machine using pure free software like the new HER is very difficult. So, as usual in life, there's compromise and people end up using open source. But I do think that some of the licensing schemes are very similar, but if possible, we should maintain some theoretical, some political commitment to the ideals of free software and explain those a little bit better than I think the community's been doing. Flossing, I think, makes it worse.
It's really simple, and I might just kind of show you back in. You said this crisis needs help in action right now.
Yeah.
So what do you want specifically?
Well, they wouldn't mind a few direct action trainings. I was at some computer conference where they said we should take over Microsoft's office in Cambridge. But, you know, it's mostly people who don't do this thing normally. It's sort of scary.
It's never going to... against the increasing
enclosure. Yeah, yeah. A lot of... So the big difference is, yes, a lot of the programmers, as pointed out earlier, do come from corporations. However, those are the dumb programmers. Almost 90%. Okay, the few people that do the majority of the work, the people who have the vision, such as Berners-Lee or Stallman, okay, tend almost exclusively to be sort of vague libertarian capitalists, but have very sympathetic to these ideas of universal global democracy. Okay, and I think that's the particular part of the class which is the most interesting part of it, the aristocracy. And a lot of them are interested in finding alliances. You know, Stallman loves new media. He wanted to visit the anti-globalization people, the WISIS polymedia lab. You know, I mean, there is potential connection. But when you corner a lot of these people and you talk about anti-capitalism Marx and you don't understand what you're talking about, that's probably a bad idea. Probably more practical help would be useful than maybe if they really like you, you could slip them whatever a copy of Storming Heaven or something, not looking at it, might be it. Hang on. Who knows? Exactly. Okay. That's it.
Very good.
Okay.
I would, taking out the point there about how we can be involved, I would, in a non-contentious vein, simply point out that this university is a factory here of production of various of the aspects of the systems that are being referred to there. When we come to the question, inquiry, I've been upstaged by a dog. Is it a dog or a cat? inquiry, inquiesta, Cambridge, looking into what's happening, who's happening, why is it happening, and where is it happening, is possibly a project for the future. However, thank you very much for that, Harry.